Gegen den Klimawandel unternimmt niemand etwas. Wer hat, dem wird gegeben werden. Und Frauen verdienen weniger. War ja immer schon so. Man ärgert sich und macht weiter. Was aber, wenn nicht? Wir haben eine Idee. Die Falter Arena macht die Bühne frei für Menschen und Projekte, die das Land verändern. Mein Name ist Eva Konzett. Ich leite das Politikressort im Falter. Und am Sonntag, den 26. Mai, veranstalten wir im Wiener Stadtsaal die nächste Falter Arena. Mit dabei unter anderem der ehemalige Politiker und Neosänger Matthias Strolz, Theresa Imre von Magda, Sonja Jöchtl von Love Politics oder Kari Ochsner von Ochsner Wärmepumpen. Machen statt jammern. Wir schauen uns an, wie das funktionieren kann. Kommen auch Sie vorbei. Alle Informationen und Tickets finden Sie unter falter.at/arena.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hereinspaziert durch unser Burgtor. Ob Burgherr, Ritterin, Stallbursche oder Gauklerin. Die Burg Liechtenstein in Maria Enzersdorf bei Wien lädt zu Erkundungen ein und weckt bei Groß und Klein die Abenteuerlust. Erbaut im Jahr 1130, ist die Burg bis heute zu 60% im Originalzustand erhalten. Waffenkammer, Turmzimmer und Ritterstube. Die Stammburg der Fürstenfamilie von und zu Liechtenstein bietet Einblicke in das Leben im Mittelalter. Besuchen Sie uns jetzt in der Erlebniswelt Burg Liechtenstein. Jeden Sonntag mit eigener Kinderführung. www.burglichtenstein.eu.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Bis zum Tod peinigt unter Wladimir Putin der Kreml seine politischen Gegner. Der Mann von Menschenrechtsaktivistin Jewgenia Karamursa, Wladimir Karamursa, ist nach dem Tod von Alexei Nawalny der prominenteste politische Gefangene Russlands. Jewgenia Karamursa ist Übersetzerin und russisch-amerikanische Aktivistin. Sie lebt mit den drei Kindern in den USA. Wladimir Karamursa, ihr Mann, ist in Russland zu 25 Jahren Gefängnis verurteilt worden, weil er den Krieg gegen die Ukraine abgelehnt hat. Er ist Journalist und ein enger Freund des vor Jahren vor den Kremlmauern ermordeten Oppositionspolitikers Boris Nemtsov. In den USA und Europa hat sich Karamursa für personenbezogene Sanktionen gegen Personen eingesetzt, die für Repressionsmaßnahmen in Russland persönlich verantwortlich sind. Es sind dies die sogenannten Magnitsky-Gesetze, die es in den USA und in der EU gibt. Schon vor Jahren war Karamursa in Russland mutmaßlich vergiftet worden. Im Gespräch mit Tessa Schischkowitz spricht Jewgenia Karamursa, wie es ihrem Mann nach dem Tod Nawalnys geht. Sein Leben ist in höchster Gefahr. Sie zeichnet Ähnlichkeiten und Unterschiede des Putin-Regimes zum Stalinismus auf. Und sie ruft dazu auf, bei den bevorstehenden russischen Präsidentschaftswahlen den Namen Nawalny auf den Stimmzettel zu schreiben. Das Gespräch im Bruno-Kreisky-Forum wurde am 20. Februar 2024 aufgenommen. Es wurde auf Englisch geführt. Zuallererst berichtet Jewgenia Karamursa von ihren letzten Kontakten zu ihrem Mann.
I have not spoken to Wladimir in almost a year, but I did receive a note from him through the prison correspondence system, prison mail system, and also his lawyer went to see him yesterday, and he found Wladimir absolutely enraged in his cell because of the murder of Alexei Navalny. Yet another one of our colleagues, yet another one, formidable, intelligent, brave, pro-democracy politician was gunned down by the Putin regime. This is not the first time in our life that this happens. In 2015, Boris Nemtsov was assassinated under the Kremlin walls. This was someone very close to Vladimir, to my husband, and he took it deeply personally, and I don't believe that he ever came to terms with that assassination, and now yet another one. Boris Nemtsov was my husband's mentor, and then he became his close friend, and then became our daughter's godfather. So in February 2015, Boris Nemtsov was assassinated, and 2 months after that, my husband Vladimir collapsed in Moscow with very weird symptoms. 2 days after that, he was in a coma with a multiple organ failure, hooked to every possible machine because none of his vital organs worked. He stayed in intensive care unit for 3 weeks in a coma. There were no guarantees that he would ever wake up. And there were no guarantees that if we did wake up, he would wake up still being Vladimir. And I remember talking to his medical team. I remember I told his doctor, his main doctor, do anything you have to do. I need my husband to wake up as my husband. Legs, arms, I'll take care of it. I don't care, I'll take care of it. He will be walking, running, driving, playing guitar. I need the amazing brain of my husband. That's Renaissance man whom I married 20 years ago, a journalist, a historian, a filmmaker, and a politician. He was also a musician at some point in his life. He played clarinet and played it quite professionally. And then came the time in his teens when he had to choose. Guess what he chose? He was choosing between music and politics. Since then, he has not touched his clarinet. The clarinet is still there at home in its wonderful small box. So I've been living for 20 years with someone who refuses to accept the future that Vladimir Putin planned for our country. I've been living with someone, been sharing my life and raising kids with someone who believes that our country deserves better. And he does not believe that because he is somehow misinformed about the Russian population. He does not believe it because he is just some unkillable optimist. No, he believes it because he saw these people, he knows these people, he worked with them. When he worked for the Open Russia Foundation of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, he traveled across the entire country, building a network of activists, journalists, young politicians around the country. And whenever he would come back home to me and the kids, he would talk about these amazing people he met there and there and there again. And he would tell me about how enthusiastic they are, how knowledgeable, what kind of informed questions they asked, how much they knew about their regions, how much they knew about the local structures that they wanted to develop. He saw the hope in these people. And this is the reason why my husband continued his work and his fight and continues even from behind bars. This is why he believes that a different future for Russia is possible, despite it all. Because the reason we see Russia in today's state is because the regime has done everything to destroy the social institutes, to destroy horizontal connections in society, to disinform society to a very deep level. The Russian population, the majority of the Russian population that still relies on TV as the main source of information, sad truth, but yes, has not had access to one single independent TV channel since 2003. That's 20 years of hearing the same message repeated again and again and again from all channels. Russia is this great country trying to get up from its knees while everyone out there wants to see Russia's demise. But Vladimir Putin did not jump out of the box. He has been on the scene for almost a quarter of a century. To some, it was obvious where he came from and what he would do to the country. Because, I always remember that story that Vladimir always goes to, and he's a historian, so he analyzes, you know, he has this amazing understanding of events, and he sees parallels that people today very often disregard or do not notice. Parallels, you know, and I mean, globally, the democracy is sleeping. We see a lot of problems. We see a rising number of political prisoners and hostages all around the world. We see that democratic institutes are not equipped to deal with the global crisis, human rights crisis. We see that democracies are not very well equipped to face those despotic regimes that are growing stronger around the world. Now, but talking about Vladimir Putin specifically, my husband often goes back to one specific incident that took place in 1999, when Vladimir Putin was still prime minister. So in that year, he put up a memorial plaque to Andropov on the KGB building in downtown Moscow. Andropov was someone who introduced punitive psychiatry in the Soviet Union. And it is to this person that Vladimir Putin decided to put up a memorial plaque in downtown Moscow on the KGB building that was KGB building because Andropov was head of KGB at a certain period. And, I remember Vladimir thought about it and said, well, that's it. That's all clear who this person is and where he would be taking the country. Today, punitive psychiatry is yet again used as one of the means of repression against dissenters in our country. So we came the full circle.
It's quite interesting. We always say like, okay, so we have now, as you say, psychiatry is used as in Stalin's time, again, for locking away people, declaring them insane. But also the general prison system is now becoming stricter and stricter. The prison sentences are longer and longer. Your husband was shockingly sentenced to 25 years in prison, which is also a higher number of years than the usual sentence at the moment for people who criticize the war. In any case, it's sort of wrong, but I was always wondering where you see the differences also with the Stalinist regime, because we so lightly now make this, not lightly, sadly, but we make this comparison, and I'm thinking we have a very strong authoritarian character of the Putinist reign, but we don't have necessarily a totalitarian system. I mean, where are the differences to Stalinism, and what's the difference also in the world, on the world stage?
There are certain elements of the Stalin era present today, and Vladimir Putin, who is very proud of his heritage, of course, in his mind, because he's a former KGB operative, the only thing that he can build is a gulag. So he goes back to those very, you know, tried methods and that were successful back then. Why not? I mean, punitive psychiatry was quite effective. Punitive psychiatry was actually introduced later. Say, prison terms of 10, 15, 25 years, this is an element of the Stalin era. And the narrative that the regime is using today is also very, it reminds me a lot of those times. Because if you reread Solzhenitsyn, that's the same narrative used by the state. There are no dissenters in the country. There is just an incredible number of criminals, spies, and traitors. And this is the way these people are portrayed. My husband's case, yes, so far he's received the longest prison sentence at one go. Alexei Navalny had years added to his sentence again and again and again. My husband was just tried and sentenced to 25 years, so a quarter of a century. And the accusations against him are very illustrative of the way dissenters are treated in Russia today. So the first accusation was that of spreading knowingly false information about the war. And that accusation, that law on spreading false information was introduced 9 days after the full-scale invasion had broken out. Because the regime realized that there would be people talking against the war. There would be people trying to voice their opposition. So a specific law was adopted to target these people. And that law, under that law, a person can go to prison for 10 to 15 years. So that was the first accusation. The second was the association with a so-called undesirable organization. Anything that has to do with human rights in Russia today is undesirable. The Sakharov Center and Memorial were both declared foreign agents and undesirables. The organization I work with, the Free Russia Foundation, a civil society organization that brings together different civil society, anti-war and pro-democracy initiatives and supports these initiatives both in Russia and outside of Russia. We create platforms for Russian-speaking communities around the world trying to rebuild the society that those horizontal links between people that the regime is doing everything to destroy. So that was the second accusation. Again, as I said, everything that has to do with human rights is being labeled as undesirable or foreign agents. Activists, politicians, journalists specifically are all foreign agents. And there is this very sad joke. Sometimes if someone has not yet been designated as a foreign agent, would look at a person and think, what's wrong with you?
But yes, so all these are sort of things that remind us of the Soviet Union and, the enemy of the people, the enemy of the state, all this sort of, these are the narratives that are coming back to haunt Russia, but also all of us in a sense. But I wonder about the differences in order to find out how we can actually break the system is a big word, but to influence, to try to get a change done. And I wonder if there's something to the fact that there is actually no underlying ideology, because that's a big difference, isn't it?
Yes, you're right. And they're trying to somehow catch up with that as well, because history books in schools are yet again being rewritten. And certain periods in history are yet again being distorted to fit this very crude ideology that they're trying to come up with. Because yes, Stalin, the Soviet Union was built on ideology. This regime began as a kleptocratic one. It was all about stealing and stealing and stealing and hiding the stolen loot in Western banking systems. and then using the privileges that are guaranteed by free societies, by free democratic countries, while repressing the rights of their own citizens back at home. So it began as a kleptocratic one, and it's true, there was no ideology. I think that they're trying to think of something. And the books that are being rewritten, they point at the fact that Vladimir Putin is actually getting ready for a long war. And that is important to understand, because these books are being rewritten not just to misinform kids, but to raise them into soldiers.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
To make out of them those good Russian citizens who understand what Russia is all about, this empire that is led by its strong leader. And yes, they were, in totalitarian societies, first there is this ideology, and then there is a war. In Vladimir Putin's case, yes, he just messed it all up. But he's trying to catch up now. And the way it is being done, and the speed at which it is being done, is truly, well, it is frightening to me, even after everything I've seen. But I think it's maybe frightening because, yeah, we don't know where we'll end up. But the thing is, you said that it would be good to know what the differences are so we could somehow influence it, change it, stop it. There is no silver bullet here. So there is no one solution, one single solution that will somehow change the course of Russia's history.
No, but for example, if you look at the war, and of course a lot of people, and we hear that also from street interviews of Russians, also in the last days again, where people say we have to finish the war because we are being attacked by the West and these kind of things. So a certain element of this ideology to think that, you know, you have to defend Russia because there's a evil Western world out there that wants to capture the nation. But I suspect that it is not as strong as Putin would wish it to be, because on the other hand, you have now seen at the run-up to the elections in the middle of March that there was a sudden hype around a somewhat independent candidate, Boris Nadezhdin, who suddenly, because he was slightly critical of the war in the Ukraine, became quite popular. So a lot of people seem to understand that this war is not good for Russia.
You are absolutely right in suggesting that there is a part of Russian society that is deeply brainwashed. And unfortunately, with no social institutes, with no freedoms left, no free elections, no freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly or association, without any democratic instruments that are available in free societies to assess the actual opinions of the people, how can we measure how big that part of the Russian population is? Because yes, of course, what you see in those opinion polls, imagine that. Those opinion polls are conducted in a near-totalitarian state where the regime uses very harsh reprisals against anyone who says, no, I'm not okay with this. In any way possible, people can end up in prison for standing in the street with a blank sheet of paper. There were arrests for holding a peaceful protest with a copy of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. In 2022 alone, at least 565 minors were arrested, and against 9 of them, criminal proceedings were initiated before the age of 18. Nikita Uvarov went to prison for 5 years. He was 16 at the time of his sentencing for planning to blow up an FSB building in the computer game Minecraft. A 72-year-old woman went to prison for 5 years for making posts about the war. So in this society, imagine being approached by someone in the street with a camera, and they say, what do you think about the war? But tell me, honestly, what would you say if you knew what might happen to you in case you told the truth? And it's, I hear sometimes answers in these street polls when people are asked the question and they would answer, I don't want to go to prison. What do you think they actually think, these people who say that? In a neo-totalitarian state, trusting opinion polls conducted in a neo-totalitarian state is a very wrong thing to do. And we should judge about the state of that population, the state of mind of people in that population, by some secondary signs. Like the fact that Russia placed second worldwide in 2022 by the number of VPN services installed. Or the fact that even despite these very harsh reprisals, thousands of people went out to lay flowers over the last 3 days to commemorate slain Alexei Navalny. Or the fact that you mentioned this short-lived campaign of Boris Nadezhdin. We saw thousands of people standing in lines in low, cold winter temperatures for hours to sign petitions for Nadezhdin. He was the only candidate running on an anti-war platform, a very cautious one, still calling the war the special military operation, but still the only candidate demanding the end of the war and calling it a crime, which is important. And so these people were there, and they didn't know who Nadezhdin was. The majority of these people were young people. And Nadezhdin is from a different generation. They haven't heard of him. They don't know who he is. They don't care. What they care is that he's anti-war. And those who knew Nadezhdin in those lines, they knew that he was quite a questionable character, to tell the truth. There are many questions that can be asked about Nadezhdin. But again, he was the only one running on an anti-war platform. And like my husband commented during a court hearing on the video, he said these people were there not to sign petitions for Nadezhdin, but to sign petitions against the war. And when they left the signatures, you need to understand that it's not just signing a piece of paper. It's leaving all your personal information, your address, your full name, and you're being filmed while you're standing in that line. And later, Vladimir Solovyov, this odious Putin propagandist, also already commented that we now know the names and the faces of all the traitors. Traitors, he called these people in lines. So these are secondary signs that show that the support that Vladimir Putin claims he has, that's got nothing to do with reality. Because the difference here is not in, I would say that it's not even the quality of people who are in the street, the quantity of people who are in the streets, but the quality of that protest, because these people do this knowing quite well that they can be thrown in jail for many years, that they can be deprived of parental rights, and that scares me the most as a mom of three, that they can be tortured and killed. We began this evening by commemorating Alexei. Well, in 2023 alone, that year alone, last year alone, according to human rights organizations, at least 50 people died during arrests or in pretrial detention across the country. At least 50. And the causes of death of the majority of these people are very questionable. They're just the circumstances of their deaths are very questionable.
But I wonder if we know now, and that was, you know, we don't know exactly how and why Navalny had to die now at this moment, but the you know, time just before the elections gives us a hint that maybe it was supposed to be shown clearly that everyone who raises their head or says something against Putin loses his life. So I imagine that it's even much more difficult now to think about strategies also how to deal with the elections. So the last idea that Navalny floated was to go at noon during the election when the stations are open and to show up just by numbers of force and say, like, okay, we're coming to the elections, but just at a certain point when everyone knows this is the opposition showing up and also crossing out all the names on the ballot paper and writing down Navalny there. Is this something that you think makes sense?
Well, I know that how important it is for people that are not alone, to know that they're not alone in this. My husband wrote to me that over the past few weeks, he'd been receiving letters talking about that short-lived campaign of Nadezhdin. And then we're not talking about Nadezhdin himself. They were saying how exhilarated they were to see these lines in the streets and to realize that they were not alone in thinking the way they thought. Because the regime is doing everything to isolate people, to make them feel like there are some weirdos and they are in the minority, that no one else thinks this way. And so that collective act allowed them to show solidarity with each other. So this is why it was incredibly important to people in Russia to be able to do this. And talking about the election, Alexei, yes, he did call. I don't remember who this initiative was launched by. But Alexei definitely supported it. Noon against Putin. And I know that all the pro-democracy forces I can think of are supporting the idea of going there at noon to show up in big numbers and also to see each other again, like in the lines putting their signatures for Nadezhdin. But also now, after the murder of Alexei, I am calling on everyone, and my husband supports this, and other pro-democracy and anti-war Russian forces are calling for the same. We are calling on Russian citizens to not just go there at noon and cross all the candidates out, but to write Navalny across the ballot. I know that my husband did that in previous elections, only he wrote Boris Nemtsov. That was a president, the best president Russia never had, like my husband says. So yes, I believe that this will be an important way for all of us to see how many of us are there and to show to the world that there are many Russians who think differently and who do not accept the future drawn by Vladimir Putin for our country.
But of course, he will still be...
Yes.
Re-crowning himself as the Tsar of Russia with any neglect of real numbers on whatever will end up on the ballot papers, his name or Navalny's name. We won't see the real numbers of anything. So wouldn't it make sense to just simply also boycott these elections and say, this is just an illegitimate president reappointing himself?
This is an illegitimate president reappointing himself. You're absolutely right. And in my talks with politicians, I point to the fact that Vladimir Putin has no legitimacy here and should be treated and called out for who he is, a criminal wanted by the ICC, by the International Criminal Court, not a legitimate leader of the Russian Federation. And there are very specific legal grounds for that. The Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe adopted a resolution following the so-called referendum in Russia in 2020 that basically destroyed the country's constitution, allowing Vladimir Putin to crown himself a czar forever. Because if you look at the amendments made to the constitution, you will realize that there is not one single thing that Vladimir Putin cannot do. He has absolute power in the country. He destroyed the country's fundamental law and acquired absolute power through doing this. The second reason, and so the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe revised these results of the so-called referendum and concluded that the referendum cannot be seen as legitimate, and hence Vladimir Putin cannot be called a legitimate president following the so-called election. So they called on all member states to declare Vladimir Putin illegitimate. Another very important ground for doing this is the fact that the election will be carried out on occupied Ukrainian territories, where people will be forced to vote. And they will be forced to vote in the right way, you know, in exchange for medication, in exchange for humanitarian aid. How can a process like that be seen as a legitimate democratic process by the democratic world? Not to mention the fact that Vladimir Putin either forced out of the country or physically eliminated all really strong contenders, to competitors to his rule. He murdered Boris Nemtsov, he murdered Alexei Navalny, he forced many politicians out of the country. So I believe that declaring Vladimir Putin as illegitimate will be a very important signal, both to the Kremlin, very important message, both to the Kremlin and to that part of Russian civil society that is trying to do everything to somehow bring closer the day when all this ends. Mm. And you see, this and this could actually have another practical effect as well, because many countries, despite sanctions, despite pressure from the international community, continue doing business with Vladimir Putin, helping him avoid sanctions, offering him these corridors, you know, just back corridors. So maybe if he were declared illegitimate, if he were declared basically a pariah, maybe such countries as India or China that does not support Vladimir Putin openly, maybe they will think twice about continuing doing business with him. I don't know, but I think this, if there is a chance that this could happen, this chance should be used.
Das Gespräch von Tessa Šiškovits mit Evgenija Kara-Murza fand am 20. Februar 2024 im Bruno-Kreisky-Forum statt. Wir haben etwas gekürzt. Beim Kreisky-Forum bedanke ich mich sehr herzlich für die Zusammenarbeit. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören. Informationen von Menschenrechtsaktivistinnen und Menschenrechtsaktivisten gibt es regelmäßig im Falter. Ich empfehle ein Abonnement. Alle Informationen gibt es im Internet unter der Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet, Miriam Hübel und Philipp Dietrich betreuen die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Folge.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50,
luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hallo liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, hier spricht Florian Schäuber. Mein Podcast Schäuber fragt nach läuft wieder auf einem eigenen Schäuber fragt nach Kanal. In der neuen Folge berichte ich über einen mit Regierungsinseraten gesponserten Hitler-Fan und den bevorstehenden Auslieferungs-Hattrick des steirischen FPÖ-Chefs Mario Kunasek. Mit der Philosophin Susan Nyman spreche ich über rechte Fans der Postmoderne, Rasterlocken und Parallelen zwischen Benjamin Netanyahu und Donald Trump. Jetzt auf Schäuber fragt nach, überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.